You are listening to the Krika Lecture Series podcast, produced by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This and other Krika podcasts are available on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more information about Krika's lecture series and public events, visit our website at krika.wisc.edu.
Good evening and welcome everyone. I am delighted to introduce Tamara Trojanovska, the Vice Dean, Faculty and Academic Life and an Associate Professor at the University of Toronto, who also happens to be my longtime mentor and one of the people responsible for ruining my career as a programmer or IT expert and getting me into this profession. So,
that is true.
But she is also a long-time role model in this position, so it evens out. Tamara Trojanovska wrote numerous articles, chapters, and essays on modern Polish literature, drama, and theater in the leading academic and non-academic journals in Poland, Canada, Great Britain, and the United States. She edited and co-edited several anthologies dedicated to these topics, including Polonistyka po amerykańsku, Badania nad literaturą polską w Ameryce Północnej in 2006, and New Perspectives on Polish Culture, Personal Encounters, Public Affairs, which came out in 2012. The latest such publication is the truly epic volume co-edited with Joanna Niżyńska and Przemysław Czapliński titled Being Poland, A New History of Polish Literature and Culture Since 1918, which came out in 2018 from the University of Toronto Press. And if I can do a bit of promotion for that volume, I can wave it ominously over the room just to kind of illustrate the scope of this new project. I will pass it around. It already has a ruined dust jacket because it's been in use quite a lot. This volume presents more than 60 essays by diverse authors from all around the world, including Professor Trojanovska's extensive analysis of the transgressive practices in Polish drama and theater, Delectatio Furiosa, or the modes of cultural transgression. Apart from being a prolific researcher and writer, Professor Trojanovska is also an immensely talented administrator. Recently, I was talking to a colleague, Klaus Anderson, who kind of made this point that we often do not, we emphasize so much our research activities that the other parts of the job are don't necessarily get the needed spotlight. She's solely responsible for maintaining and transforming the Polish program at the University of Toronto into one of the most robust programs of this type in North America, right beside UW-Madison, while serving as director of the University College Drama Program from 2008 to 2012. She integrated her unit with the graduate program at the Center for Drama, Theater, and Performance Studies. The next 4 years, she served as the director of the center, where she co-founded the BMO Lab in Creative Research in the Arts, Performance, Emerging Technologies, and AI. Her current research focuses on the transgressive intersections of drama and theater with history, philosophy, and religious imagination, with particular interest in the issues of identity, the result of which will be the book project that today's talk is largely based upon. So please join me in welcoming our guest.
Oh, thank you, Łukaszu. It's such a joy not only to be welcomed so warmly, but also to be welcomed by a former student and a colleague, because Łukasz has been a colleague for a long time, even when he was a student. So thank you so much, and also deep appreciation for the invitation to be here. I feel humbled. No questions asked. It's a task to present in this forum, and also, of course, thank you to all of you for coming at the very end of the semester when I can only imagine how exhausting the last few weeks must have been, or months, and how much you must be looking forward to having a break. So a double thank you for that as well. And I will just go, I know we are limited in time, and I do want to leave some time for the discussion, and yet I also expect that I might have been a bit overindulgent, so I will try to still keep my reading pace as appropriate for a lecture, and if I pass the 40 minutes and go into 45, please just forgive me for that. So what is at stake in my project on transgressive crypto-theologies in the 20th century Polish theater is its legacy of its post-metaphysical existentialism, a contradictory stance to begin with, and to say the least. The project fits into a broader framework of European post-secular debates and, quote, a spectrum of concerns and possibilities they offer to the study of Polish theater and drama. I call on Stanisław Ignacy Witkiewicz, pen name Witkacy, Witold Gombrowicz, Tadeusz Kantor, and Tadeusz Różewicz, and a handful of their works foregrounding art and the artist figure to understand their compulsion to create, to crave meaning over the abyss of nothingness, and to assert their individual uniqueness and freedom in impossible and yet compelling negotiations between transcendence and immanence. Our inquiry's leading question is whether and how the works of these provincial Europeans and self-described monsters who lived through their art and sought their salvation in it in specific cultural and historical contexts are still relevant to our reading of the world today. In addition to reinterpretive readings of their works, and I will offer one in the second half of my thought, just so not to stay in this sort of general discourse, but give you a clear example of what I mean by it in practical terms. In addition to this, to those readings, the project's potential lies in the revalorization of some persistent stereotypes about Polish culture, including the complaints voiced by many 19th and 20th centuries intellectuals about Polishness as neither sufficiently intellectual nor intense spiritually, hence not heretical enough, as too tepid because of its inherent attraction to comfort. These views, shared by such diverse thinkers as Stanisław Brzozowski, Roman Dmowski, Witold Gombrowicz, and Czesław Miłosz, among many others, constitute a strong tradition of radical criticism of Polish cultural paradigms embraced by the Polish intelligentsia over the last two centuries. The precarious dynamics of strength and weakness, intensity and idleness, passion and ease, their allure and disavowal, continuity and disruption has shaped Polish culture in its eccentric, if not scandalous, paradigm of Catholicism, with its historical and cultural particularities, and heretical Romanticism, with its lasting and constantly contested cultural capital, and its modernity, and left a deep mark on my artists, I call them my artists from now on, whose works both embrace and disrupt these traditions. So our journey takes us from the end of the 19th century, when royal houses were solidly standing in Europe, through the barbarity of the 20th century, when they, alongside other foundations of the Western civilization, crumbled, first in the trenches of the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, and then in the killing fields, gas chambers, and gulags, to the first decade of the 21st century, with its changing maps and borders, unprecedented speed of technological advances, challenging even further our understanding of the sense and meaning of our finite and still inexplicable existence. None of those four artist-defining voices in the 20th century Polish theater and drama limits his understanding of history to a Marxist combustion of material forces, economic... I just went with my cursor too fast. economic interests and class struggle, although they appreciate the impact of these factors on the shape of the world and our experience of it. To each, the generative but also pernicious cultural and historiosophical alternative of the Polish Romantics' messianic concepts about Poland's role in the divine plan for the humanity is a negative point of reference. But for them, history takes root in individual interdependencies, social interactions, and institutional, that is, state and military mechanisms, and our species' propensity for cruelty and violence. They keep their eyes open to the advances of mass psychology, abusing our susceptibility to complacency, irrational infatuation, and moral impunity, and to ideological strategies of transforming individuality into instrumentality. In other words, their sources of historical evils are never far away from the sources of individual neuroses, desires and ambitions, and from what happens spontaneously or by coercion between people when compassion fails, as it indeed easily does in our society. So, not surprisingly, our artists are well aware of these events' impact on the viability of art to tell our stories, find a language to do so, make it meaningful to others in the world where things may or do not make sense any longer. And yet create they must against all odds. Witkacy in an induced frenzy and histrionic desperation. Gombrowicz with emotional void weaponizing his oddities. Kantor with a megalomaniac force, and Różewicz with unrelenting doubt and depressive bouts. Their wounded artist figures traverse and transgress the riveting and explosive intersections of bios and zoe, logos and silence, and mythos and experience. That is what is individual, the mode of life, and the manner of living, and life without properties, the biological life of all living beings. What is rational, explicable, and in its religious meaning, a divine word becoming flesh in Christ, and what is irrational, silent, and forgotten. Finally, of how we have communicated our values over the ages, transformed them into our cultural collective memory and the discursive practices of history, and what is embodied. The contextualized close readings, or as Marjorie Perloff puts it, reading closely of carefully chosen dramatic texts and theater productions, reveal the sacrificial and crypto-theological horizons of these writers' psychobiographies. What does that mean? Well, the sacrifice in their works evokes the ancient Greek idea of the pharmakon, a drug that is both a remedy and a poison, and directs us to the pharmakos, the scapegoat. This figure becomes essential to our understanding of the relationship between zoe and bios, the biological and the existential, the individual and the community, giving such an individual identity its social form, style, mode, shape of existence, and the social and cultural rituals that are the core of Polish theater's transgressive tradition. Such lens also allows us to perceive the discussed artists as pharmakes, simultaneously healers, druggists, and poisoners, wizards, magicians, and sorcerers, transgressors by definition, and the risk they often take of also becoming pharmakoi, the scapegoats. Finally, the scapegoat highlights the ambiguities of anamnesis, so important in Kantor's work, for example, a calling to remembrance, a memorial sacrifice, as it functions at the crossroads of Plato's epistemology, the knowledge collected throughout medical history, and the Eucharistic reminiscence of Christ's sacrificial passion, resurrection, and ascension. The latter, quote, "the scandalous, absurd, and surreal event of God's crucifixion, as Agatha Bielik Robson puts it, it still holds a powerful place in Western civilization, notwithstanding the vigorous defiance against it. This defiance resonates with our inhibited capacity to entertain the meaning of pain, suffering, and evil. Shuddering at this scandalous absurdity and a stumbling block, a proper meaning of scandalon, to Western rationalism, and revering God partaking in nothingness of human existence, as Heidegger has it, translates into our artist's twofold transgressive gestures, typical of ritual, of sacrificial rituals, of sacrum and profanum, exaltation and degradation, outright mockery, physical crudeness, linguistic profanities, cruelty and violence, crossing the thresholds of pains, sufferings, and evils' incomprehensibility. The sacrificial horizon is closely related to the crypto-theological. Like Katarzyna Flader-Rzeszowska's use of the term in her analysis of Tadeusz Kantor's writings, I borrow it from Agatha Bielik-Robson's analysis of European modernity and Jewish philosophy to examine the questions that Polish drama and theater ask about the sense of life and death. The Polish philosopher understands cryptotheology as a post-secular position somewhere between the revealed religion and a disappearing trace of transcendence, a longing, a search for the no longer possible that is still deeply rooted within the inherited possibility, but not referred to openly anymore. Cryptotheology thus points to the persistence of religious thinking in late modernity, even in its utterly secular artistic projects, and as such questions the successful secularization of modern society and culture. Or, as Bielik-Robson elsewhere says, quote, modernity, far from being just the age of the death of God, emerges as the time of God's most surprising survival. It also, end of quote, it also valorizes those thinkers who are shaped by theological traditions over those shaped by the Greek classics when they engage the problems of existence. And this already can give you a hint of a certain caveat in her works on cryptotheology, as she fiercely distances herself from Christianity's main ideas and considers Judaism with its Gnostic versions a model foundational religion capable of speaking to our existential horrors. So I borrow her term while not subscribing fully to such limitations, but still appreciating her stance on vitalism and the side of life itself. It allows us to understand how self-confirmation allows our artists to preserve their individual uniqueness in confrontation with negativity. And finally, in this project, psychobiography is the writer's crypto-autobiographical inclination, rather than the methodology of practicing psychology when writing their biographies. I now have doubts about whether the psychobiography will actually do what I needed to do, but I try not to use crypto autobiography because there would be too much crypto in what I'm trying to do. And, you know, I don't want this to turn into fluid, this and that, as the term had made it into multiple books elsewhere. So those, in both cases, this compound term still pauses at the crossroads of psychology and biography. It does so at the level of the artist's individual mental landscapes and their struggles to understand themselves and others in an artistic form. No one is a better ally in such an approach than Gombrowicz in his famous diary's first entry. Monday me, Tuesday me, Wednesday me, Thursday me. And with the following confession, nothing stuns me more and intoxicates me more as much as my life, the abyss that creates me. So psychobiography returns my author's into their works and in part explains their obsessive self-interpretations and the care with which they project their place in posterity. They were hurt, irritated, and enraged by the indifference of critics and readers, but even more by the inattentive misreading of their works. They fought for recognition like the religious man fights for salvation, recognizing art as the only way for the non-believer to salvation, and the only salvation from the instrumental mind of the world. One can also understand them as syllectic subjects created in the process of double encoding, as conscious subjects using language and unconscious subjects that are spoken by it, as subjects writing and interpreting themselves and others like texts, but also being determined by the text they create, as creators and the created, the interpreters and the interpreted. Such is the splinter of creation, of the creator hiding in the deep structures of his creation. No wonder that all four artists are tempted and terrified by the prospects of our creative power and its consequences. And now I would like to set the stage to actually see how it is done in an actual text. And I will be focusing on a text on which I am quite obsessed with, and that is Gombrowicz's The Marriage, a text I've written quite a few times about that I still am reading with awe and still do not fully understand it. So Gombrowicz says it's definitely his indisputable masterpiece, and he says about it, it's a Mount Sinai, a place full of mystical revelations, a cloud pregnant with 1,000 meanings, a galloping work of imagination and intuition, a grand guignol full of play, a puzzling missa solemnis on the threshold of time at the foot of an unknown altar. Shakespearean in its dramatic and philosophical aspirations, it is also one of his most disturbing texts. I will give you a short interpretive synopsis of it for those who have never had a pleasure and haven't experienced a tremor of reading it in Polish or English. So in it, Henry, a traumatized soldier fighting in France during the Second World War, returns home. He's won another Gombrowiczian prince, but this time one of delirious making, buffeted by a historical Armageddon and tempted by Gnostic impulses. The play opens in a theatrically heightened landscape of a ruined church and the shattered transcendence left by its desecration. And we have the opening monologue right here.
I'll try to get it back up.
Sure. And because I will be referring to it. So its transformations, first into uncanny family home, referencing by name Gombrowicz's Małoszyce, but emerging as a shoddy inn, and then into a royal palace that becomes a prison, contributes, of course, to the heterotopic features of the space. When defending his family's lost dignity, because his father and mother emerge as deranged innkeepers and his fiancée Molly a slut, against the aggressive drunkards storming the inn, Henry pays homage to his parents and elevates them to the royal status. Like in many Shakespearean tragedies and history plays, which The Marriage emulates, though this tradition, of course, goes back to the Greeks, a familial story becomes a political history as war ravages Henry's kingdom. His father's royalty carries a promise of a sanctified marriage, but the ceremony never materializes. Incited by the chief drunkard and by his own doubts and unease, Henry declares himself the king, imprisons the parents and the tempter, and seizes the total control. He plans to marry Molly by a rite of his own making in the what he calls the sacred human church he's building, and expects its effectiveness to match that of the sacred ritual. underestimating the pressure of human interactions, language, and the repressed chaos of his impulses, he falls victim to his prisoners when they implicate Johnny, Henry's army buddy and alter ego, as Molly's lover. When Henry successfully demands that Johnny commit suicide, and as the final test of his power, his project collapses. Like ancient and modern tyrants, Henry, threatened by his imminent overthrow, becomes a prisoner of his obsessive, violent, and persecutory system. Ultimately, he imprisons himself as if recognizing that such is the price for abandoning the negotiations between transcendence and immanence, as crypto-theology claims. We should reckon with his sending the emissaries of his thwarted project into the world. They are among us. Crypto-theology, apocalyptic unveilings. In the marriage, the sense of loss and alienation, the fluidity of returns and departures, openings and closures, of what is external and internal, and the porous boundaries between self and others shape the place structure of human experience. Henry joins the, quote, demonic figures such as Faust, Macbeth, and Dostoevsky's Stavrogin, who continue to stare at us from the canonical center of Western literature, end of quote. And yet, while saving his stare from, quote, baleful accusation and the burnt-out eyes of these characters, Gombrowicz sends him on a similar path of destructive impunity in a world demonically alienated from life. It is an oniric journey. A perceptive and persuasive self-interpreter, the playwright compares such dreaming to prophesizing. He writes, "This is a dream about our epoch that expresses the suffering of our modern times. But it is also a dream that is a forerunner of the epoch. It is a dream that attempts to decipher the times. On the peripheries of the action, the slumbering spirit of the protagonist artist wants to break through the darkness. This is a dream battle with the demons of tomorrow, that is today. This is a celebration of the holy ritual of the becoming of the new and unknown." Well, the terms he's using are not accidental. The play has both diagnostic and prophetic ambitions. His praise of the artistic perfection of dreams in the marriage goes hand in hand with the declaration that Henry resembles an artist in a state of inspiration rather than a person who dreams. As old-fashioned as this notion of creativity seems, Gombrowicz embraces its neo-gnostic roots and the modern idea of artists as visionaries offering unique insight into their times. Such understanding of artistic inspiration stretches between the mysterious incitation's playful and hazardous precariousness and embraces wide-ranging referentiality. Its similarities to prophesizing feed off rich biblical interpretation of such activities and their romantic reconfigurations. Inspiration straddles both religious and aesthetic semantic registers, explained William Franke, and Gombrowicz takes full advantage of this notion. In the biblical tradition, prophets were charismatic teachers whose task was not so much foretelling the future as the effective shaping of it. Granted, they were shaping it based on the obedience to the faith in one God, whereas Gombrowicz's artist shapes his by following the mimetic demonism of intersubjective impulses and desires. Yet still, the assertion that, quote, prophecy in the central strand of Western literary tradition is not primarily about predicting the future, it is rather about seeing deeply into the overall meaning of history and the cosmos so as to be able to convey their truth in a way that is total and as such tantamount to a type of divine revelation, reflects fully Gombrowicz's aspirations. It also follows the fundamentally religious recognition that prophetic revelation has the same truth value as a philosophical argument, even though it comes in a dream or a vision. The revelation of his truth and the new beyond it signifies are at the core of Gombrowicz's creative genius. Its equation with creativity is what Gombrowicz learned from Nietzsche, not without reason, called by René Girard the greatest theologian of modern times. Seeing such creativity as a core of a new type of transgressive relationality was his own invention. In this context, the marriage's references to the desecrated church and the war make the most sense. And this is the opening monologue that in so very many different analyses of the play, and there are plenty of fantastic interpretations of the marriage, no one has ever paid any attention to this opening monologue beyond saying that it is a landscape of a desecrated church. And many of my wonderful predecessors were actually saying, you know, this is a bit of a gibberish. And so I decided to pay attention to it and think that actually it's no gibberish at all. Quite the contrary, it is the very core of Gombrowicz's insane project, and of course Henry's insane project. So the two, if time is ever out of joint, it is during the war. The two closely related dwellings, the church and the home, along with the metaphysical orders they once signified, are no more. The destruction of one means the degradation of the other, and Henry's return takes preposterous forms. His homecoming is an attempt to feel at home in the world. This longing must be based on a model of creation. Only a notion of a creator who does things according to intentions gives rise to a theodicy, for homes are the products of conscious, indeed beneficent thought. Of course, we long for a world to feel at home in. And that was a quote. It was Freud who made the desire, quote, seem not deep but embarrassing. And it is Freud who has his hand, as we will see mostly his finger, in Henry's experience. What made perfect sense architecturally and culturally in the past is now obscure, and these are quotes from the monologue, incongruous and strange. The church structure and its spiritual equivalents are now the abyss of the abyss and pile of stones. The portal, of which Henry is obsessively mindful, becomes impenetrable. The altar deformed, and the worship, the Holy Book of Psalms, estranged. The theological and historical transference of the Psalter's role to communicate with God to a new kind of prayer through the offering of bread and wine that transubstantiates into the body and blood of Christ the Shepherd, it is all interpreting the monologue, as a commemoration of his sacrificial offering and redemption, stagnates and becomes absurd. So the violent rupture of the old world in the marriage shuts off the doors to the religious, but not to metaphysical experience. In turn, this apocalypse opens freedom's riveting potential, whimsical underside, and terrifying prospects. Including the demonic. For, quote, the demonic is now the back door into spirituality and religion, where the front door appears to be shut or destroyed. The prevalent form of modern religious experience, as Fernie explains in his wonderful book about the demonic in literature. Henry, as self-proclaimed son of war, stands on the civilizational ruins of the Judeo-Christian tradition, disinherits himself from familial ties in favor of a violent historical kinship, and explores the potential of this new mode of existence. The war in the marriage refers to the actual event in the 20th century European history as much as it stands on its own, genetic referentiality to conflict, violence, cruelty, and struggle that mark human interactions. Everything that follows in this play happens in this matrix. The language of this opening monologue, as I said, rarely addressed in the play's analysis, reverberates with what William Franke calls the, quote, philosophical and artistic phenomenologies of revealment. Its opening line, "The curtain has risen," pertains to the stage, the world, and Henry's self. In the marriage, this triple directionality defines the order of existence and human experience as permanent in-betweenness, as both fluid and combative relationship between the real and the illusory, the objective and the subjective, the outer and the inner, the social and the individual, the definitive and the performative, the sacred and the profane, between freedom and determinism, instinct and reason, to name but a few. By referencing the centuries-old metaphor of Teatro Mundi and its implications for human freedom, the rising curtain is also an apt image of the dominant strategy of unveiling that is at work in the play as it rehearses the rise of new immanence on the ruins of transcendence. The curtain also rises on Henry's discoveries as he's breaking through the darkness, whether sensorial, cognitive, psychological, or unethical, alongside Johnny and the drunkard, towards some illumination of what the repercussions of these revelations may hold. When viewed in tandem with Gombrowicz's aspiration of making the play a forerunner of the epoch, a dream that attempts to decipher the times, and a dream battle with the demons of tomorrow, the centrality of unveiling in the marriage signals its connections to modern gnosis. The play abounds in Henry's gestures and promises of illumination. The idea of the interhuman church replaces divine transcendence with what Masłowski suggests is horizontal metaphysics, and in yet another take with Girardian deviated transcendence. It ends up, however, as a totalitarian enterprise and follows what Erik Voglin identifies as the Gnostic impulse of the 20th century political ideas. As he explains, all Gnostic movements are involved in the project of abolishing the constitution of being with its origin in divine transcendent being and replacing it with a world immanent order of being, the perfection of which lies in the realm of human action. The opening monologue also references the symbolism and apocalyptic tone of John's Book of Revelation and Christ's Little Apocalypse, two best-known Christian examples of revealment that may also point to the violent end of time. Henry's seal sinking into the black abyss of the immobile cosmos suggests a demonic reality marked by the sign of the apocalyptic beast rather than the sign of God. Such sign is also a distant echo of one of the seven seals that in John symbolize the wholeness of historical reality presented from the perspective of Revelation, which in the play loses its divine master. Henry's vision of the ruined church recalls Christ prophesying of the destruction of the temple, the center of the Jewish religious life, in his speech on the Mount of Olives. The consequences of God no longer having a home to call his people are as dire. The destruction of the temple in 70 AD gave rise to the most profound change in Judaism from its biblical to post-biblical rabbinical form. It also provided a theological turning point for St. Matthew to mark the deepening and then final diversion from Judaism of the Palestinian Judeo-Christianity that laid the claim to a replacement of the synagogue by Jesus' new church. Henry's project echoes this process when he proclaims a new interhuman church to replace the one whose ruins, this is all right, he encounters at the outset of his existential adventure. This adventure is mimetic and performative at its core, transposing the enchantment of vertical transcendence into its horizontal interhuman rendering and unfolding as an alternative to to the ruined church formal civilization building power. It follows the performative understanding of what constitutes any identity and practice, whether individual, cultural, social, or political, best put in the Nietzschean fashion as the deed preceding inner condition, conviction or belief. Yet, in the marriage, it does so by emulating, subverting, and competing with the discursive power of the existing model of such performativity. So under Gombrowicz's hand, in Henry's state of inspiration, mimesis becomes subversive poesis, and mimicry becomes an alienating, highly self-referential force of mockery. As the opening set transforms into a familial scene, Henry sees himself becoming a priest, celebrating his father in a quasi-Eucharistic liturgical service. His performative kneeling, intentional and unintentional at the same time, elevates the father to an untouchable royal status, recalling and mocking the divine rights of kings, which Henry will soon claim for himself. And in, I can see that I went too far, too long. So I will now skip the rest of it, which refers back to Mount Sinai and Missa Solemnis and the Mysterium Tremendum in their various referential points, which of course makes sense, I believe, in the interpretation offered above. And also how is set up in this opening monologue refers Henry to become a model representative of someone who wants unbound freedom, and as a matter of fact, has none by his own doing. So in the end, the marriage is a dangerous weapon, a profusely subversive vehicle of demonic replacement in which the sacrificial death is self-inflicted, that's Johnny's, his friend's, in response to a whim and futile efforts to remedy human condition and the structure of reality. And yet it speaks both, volumes to both. So, as maybe the last few sentences, I would say that this type of analysis exercised regarding all four artists allows me to see anew the way in which culture and religion relate to each other in transgressive ways, without the sort of putting the accusations of the lukewarm and quite complacent Polish attitude on the one hand, or sort of orthodox religious and quite unforgiving to shed some new light. The reason why it can shed new light is also because these four, which I also talk in the book about, have become, were at the time, and have become really the sort of giants of the 20th century Polish theater and drama, and really impacted the work of very many theater directors and other people. And they also speak to each other, but that is a topic for a different talk. Thank you.